5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Gut stuff might be uncomfortable for you to talk about, but it's even more uncomfortable for you to deal with. And you have better things to do this year. Don't let your gut get in the way of that. Kick off the year of the habit and get science-backed digestive support during Ritual's New Year's sale. Their 3-in-1 clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and postbiotic help support a balanced gut microbiome. The delayed release capsule is designed to help reach the colon where probiotics can actually survive and grow, so you can focus less on your gut and more on sharpening your salsa dancing skills or whatever your 2026 goals are. Start a habit that sticks with 40% off your first month, plus a free gift with purchase at ritual.com/podcast. That's ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 24 with attorney Michael Osbrook. Michael came on the show to talk with Bob not just about the Chris Bynum case, but about process in general. They touched on conviction integrity units and much more. We have some feedback and questions from listeners. Unfortunately, we are sans Zach today, but we are going to jump in and talk about this episode. First, do we have any housekeeping?
Not other than just kind of touching base with where we're at. As I told you guys last week, my plan was to hit pause on season 17 and move on to season 18. I told you I was putting together an episode about, you know, learning where you're at as far as if you're in custody, where your custodial situation is and what your rights are and how you should interact with officers in situations like that. I'm still doing that episode. We're actually going to do it this week. And truthfully, time-wise, based on some feedback I've had, I'll talk a little bit about the end. It's actually probably better this week. But when I brought Michael on, really the intention was just to talk about process, and then we just got into the Bynum discussion, which is why it was still part of season 17. But so as of now, and I did speak with one of Chris's attorneys. We do have things in the work. It's a process for us to line up with the prison and with the attorneys to set up the call. But we are going to have an interview with Chris coming up, so we will bounce back then. In the meantime, we're just going to plug along with season 18, where we're just going to, you know, we're going to try to educate and inform and help, you know, shine a light on as many areas of the criminal justice system as we can along the way. So that's what will be coming up this Sunday. And this episode shouldn't be, you know, Michael is, you can tell not only is he an extremely talented attorney, but you could also tell he's a professor because he covered the material in such depth. I already knew who's going to ask a question. Like, there's no questions left. And that seems to be, we only have just a handful of questions. So we're, you know, we'll talk as long as we feel like yapping. And then we're not going to drag this thing out because you guys didn't have a lot of questions. Everybody seemed to love Michael's episode. So we'll cover what we got and we'll move on from there. Jana, did you personally have any takeaways before we get into the listener stuff?
Well, it was really cool to hear from Michael on this podcast. As you teed in to the episode itself, he is familiar to some of us who follow, for example, Andrea Burkhart or Bob Mata, have definitely watched or listened to conversations that he's participated in with respect to the Delphi case and other cases. So it was very cool to find out that he is involved in Chris Bynum's case. And of course, once I remembered that he's Indiana and it's Indiana, it made all the sense in the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really cool to hear you guys talking about it and just to get his perspective on, as you said, you know, not just sort of how he sees things from a federal perspective. One of the things that I thought was really interesting and kind of, I realized like, oh, I think I am guilty of this, was when he mentioned that for some of us who get frustrated with what happens, you know, on a more regional or like state level, that you suddenly count on federal, like the federal level as like, this is going to clean things up somehow. Like these people are going to be less attached to the material. And therefore, maybe they'll catch something that, you know, made it through to that point. And it is, that's supposed to be what happens with the checks and balances system. And we have seen it work that way for sure. We've definitely seen convictions be overturned by state Supreme Courts, for example. But yeah, just hearing him not necessarily wanting to rain on anyone's parade, but just to kind of be like, look, make no mistake, it's very challenging on that level as well. And then just hearing about the work that he and his students did and the success rate that they had was really exciting and inspiring.
Yeah. And to me, it was so helpful. I'm still not sure I got it all the way, but it was very helpful. The breakdown he gave of how, because I'm sure you heard, like, I had a document in front of me and I was still struggling to like, okay, so wait, it goes from here to what, then there, and then is that back to state or are we back to federal, and then Supreme Court's a different animal. He just did such a good job of and being patient with me going through that, because I get, you know, as I mentioned, like in the Pinyon Pines case, I'm still so baffled by where things are at in that process. It was like, well, we're waiting on the hearing for the federal habeas and we're getting ready to file in state. I'm like, wait, what? Does that come before that? And right. So that kind of helped break down where all that stuff was at. But Michael is just absolutely brilliant. And actually, I didn't know if anybody wanted or if he really wanted to talk about Chris's case, because we haven't mentioned that he's part of this. So that was a surprise to me, too. I wasn't planning on talking about Chris's case, but I'm glad we did, because he, you know, Michael is brilliant and he's done a ton of work on the case. It was cool to hear him kind of bring out some of the details that we didn't know.
I like listening to him. In particular, I'm thinking of, I wish I could remember exactly what it was, but there was a very interesting conversation, I think, with, I want to say it was Bob and Andrea and Michael. And in particular, Andrea and Michael, I think, having done so much kind of post-conviction work and appellate law and stuff like that, it was really interesting. It's really interesting when you have two people who really respect each other and who have a similar breadth or background or interest or whatever expertise. And to hear them not necessarily agree on next steps that should be taken, that really helps you understand the nuances of just all the different approaches that you can take in post-conviction work, and that not everybody is going to think the same plan is the right plan. And so I find that all very interesting. I mean, this is a group of people, you know, listening, Truth and Justice listeners, they like to get into the weeds a little bit. So they get it. They get that that's all very interesting to me.
Well, and I've been a part of so many of those strategy that not that anybody's looking for me for a legal strategy, but, you know, I've worked with attorneys on cases where we've been having the discussion, and my role in some of those have been, what do we need you to go out and find for us, Bob, for us to do this thing?
Sure.
But I've always, it's been these last coming on 11 years now have been so enlightening for me to understand how the system works, and particularly how the post-conviction system works, because it doesn't work the way you want it to. You know what I mean? Like, when I first got into this, it was like, oh, here's evidence that shows he's innocent. So clearly, they'll let him go.
Call someone and let's get into that courtroom.
Yeah,
right?
Like, how do we just get him out of here? And then you realize it's obviously more complicated than that. But then also, like, all the procedural things, like we were talking about how, you know, situations where we have enough information here to file a writ to try to get the conviction overturned, but it might not be enough. You know, Jesse's case, for example. Now, forget the conviction integrity unit. Let's just say with Jesse's case, you know, we have Troy recanting. Well, then, you know, his attorneys may have to decide, okay, do we file the habeas based on this new evidence and take our shot, our one bite at the apple, knowing that if it fails, that we're done, we're dead in the water. Or what else can we do? Could we do some more DNA testing? Could we do this? What else could we stack on top of it? You know, I mean, you look at, we, I was going to bring it up with Michael, but we just never circled back around to it. I mean, look at what happened with Adnan when we're talking about procedural situations. The first time his conviction was overturned based on the cell phone evidence.
Right.
It got overturned. It was held up in the next court. And then finally, I don't know if it was the Maryland Supreme Court or which layer of court it was. I think it was the Maryland Supreme Court. You know, they said they reinstated the conviction, not because it wasn't a sound argument, but because they didn't bring it up in a previous appeal, which meant it wasn't new and therefore it was time barred. So even though they agreed that made his trial unfair and he should get a new trial, it doesn't matter. You still don't get a new trial because you didn't follow the right procedure.
Right. Yeah, that particular place and time and case, I have to imagine, you know, people like Colin Miller and Michael are just using as examples and will forever, because that's a perfect representation of kind of feeling like maybe it's meant to make you go crazy. And I know it's not, and that is coming from the most layperson point of view, but that's a perfect example of something where you just kind of want to pull your hair out because you get into the kind of procedural and then the like, it could have been this and it could have been this. And then you see stuff like, you know, and obviously Kathleen Zellner has worked on cases of hours, but like I remember in Making a Murderer, she had that like giant stack of paper. And I had this, even then, not knowing very much, I had this worry, like, is it too much? You know, what's not enough? Is when's the right time? When do you strike? And when is it possible that, like, are you giving too, like, is it overwhelming and like it, everything cancels itself out? Like we've talked about that with Chris's case, you know, it's just a lot. It's a lot to wrap your head around.
Yeah, it's at least from a layman perspective like mine. When I look at Chris's case, you know, I look at the Matthews confession in the affidavits, the four affidavits that we had covered kind of the week before we covered that one. And it was like, I almost feel like the Matthews affidavit hurt him more than it helped him. It wasn't going to be enough to overturn the conviction, but what it did is it took away some of the credibility of what I think is probably, in my opinion, was probably more credible, better credible information in those affidavits, you know? So there's these weird balancing act all the time.
It's stressful. It's really stressful.
Oh, we got Michael's in the chat right now, by the way. So,
oh, hi, Michael. Wonderful.
Anybody throws a question at him, he's right here.
If there's any, well, I'll have to re-look at this. There, it may be very useful to have him in here. Whether or not that's true, it's great to have you here, Michael.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Let's jump into some questions and see where we get.
Okay,
so let's start with Kathleen. Kathleen has a couple of questions. First, she says, the shoes aren't in evidence. Any way to check if that's true? What about the socks? My thoughts are that Sheila may have been carried by her feet and hands, causing her shoes and socks to fall off, which could mean the killer's DNA and fingerprints could be on those items.
Yeah, and I believe there was an exclamation point in there at the beginning.
Shoes aren't in evidence, exclamation mark.
Evidence?
Like, holy shit.
Yeah. I mean, short of inspecting the actual evidence room, you know, from what Michael told us, and again, he's in the chat, he can chime in if there's something different than the way I understood it. You know, we have the evidence logs of what they collected and what they preserved in the shoes and socks aren't. Well, now I'm drawing up, like, weren't there, didn't we decide there were socks on one of her feet? I don't remember. Michael will know if he's paying attention down there. But as far as the shoes go, yeah, that's insane that they weren't. But even whether they carried her by her, you know, arms and ankles to move her back there or not, which I personally, I find unlikely because she's nude, right? So like the shoes would have come off before in order for the pants to come off. So I doubt that that's the case. But what we know now, and they should have known even in 2000, is the shoe being out in the middle of the ball field, especially that one, you can be almost assured that the killer touched those. Like I don't think she threw her own shoe out in the middle of the thing, which means the killer's touched DNA. It's like one of the few things, and we always talk about this, like when we have a crime scene, there's all the different places, right, where you can get DNA. We talked a little, you know, in the previous episode about the Bill Little's murder, Jamie Snow case. Like that's up because you can get DNA and you can get fingerprints, but it's not going to help. You know, there's a chance it won't help because there's a million different reasons for it to get on there. But you're always looking for like, what is a thing that if someone's DNA is on that, it is almost certainly connected to the crime.
Right.
And in this case, we can, with reasonable assurity, the killer threw her shoe out there. And so if you find a DNA profile from one of our suspects or somebody in CODIS or something like that on that shoe, you can almost be certain they were involved in the murder.
Right.
And so it's shy. I guess I didn't realize that until Michael brought it up, that they didn't even collect them.
Yeah. And he says it is absolutely true about the shoes. Only 11 things on that evidence list. He mentions there is a single work boot and no one knows where that came from.
That's insane.
It's insane.
It's absolutely insane. And we talked about, too, that, you know, the more and more I look at the crime scene, and especially after our episode with Colin, where we broke down where the drag patterns were and the blood patterns, I am convinced, at least close to being fully convinced, that Sheila was killed back by the dugouts in the same area where Liz was killed, which then means that pool of blood all the way back by the car is extremely significant. It seems like that would be a very, very, very good chance. That is the blood of our killer.
Right.
And, you know, as I mentioned in the episode where we broke down that crime scene way back, that gunshot wound into Sheila's head absolutely passed through something else first.
Right.
There's no question about, you know, and I had way back then had proposed the theory, like, what if you have, you know, two or three people and somebody is like, dude, what are you doing? And tries to stop them from shooting. It seems like a crazy thing. And maybe it is crazy, but like, I don't think it's unreasonable to think that that shot could have went through one of the killer's hands, you know, or arm or something, if they were trying to stop them from shooting her, because that bullet was deformed before it ever got to her head. So, you know, that's just another spot where, like, you could have a pool of the killer's blood sitting right there, plain as day.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really hard. Again, we are constantly armchair quarterbacking and looking back and retrospect and, you know, not knowing what we don't know. But like other cases we've discussed, I'm definitely thinking about Pinyon Pines and the wheelbarrow, for example. Like, it's so hard to imagine the conversation, if even there was one, about not picking certain things up and just, you know, just being like, no, just leave that.
It's so hard for me without knowing these detectives, like in like having a real good detailed look at what they've done in other cases, like Bertozzi, particularly the crime scene investigator, like, just trying to, like, was he just terrible at his job? It's like, it's hard to know, like, is this like intentional or are they not looking? But I mean, that was before they even, you know, supposedly they even knew Chris was a part of it. I don't think they knew at the beginning, like when they're processing the crime scene, it's like, hey, we're going to frame somebody, so don't get any, like, that doesn't make sense.
Right. No, exactly.
So it's like, does he just bad at his job, or did they do these things and then shitbox him out of the file? Before, you know, it's like once they get Chris, it's like, let's get rid of the shoes, get rid of that blood. We need to get, we don't just act like you never took any of that stuff. Don't put that stuff in your report.
It's all bad.
Yeah, I don't know, but it sure seems more likely than a professional crime scene investigator not documenting the crime scene any better than he did, not collecting all the evidence from that crime scene. I mean, 11 pieces of evidence in a quintuple homicide across two crime scenes? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, no way.
Yeah, it's crazy. All right, Kathleen also says, Michael mentioned that Bertozzi's report said something about blood north of the bodies that wasn't photographed. Could this be the blood by the dugout? It's confusing where the blood actually is from the photos, but Colin really cleared this up with his analysis.
Yeah, I think that the only blood that I've seen from the pictures that is south of the bodies is just that bit of blood on the shingles by the car. I think everything else is north of there, like between, mm-hmm. So you got the trail going back towards the dugout, the drag trail, you've got the big blood pool where the cones were at. So north of the bodies is, but then also like what, and I don't know if Michael was just generalizing or if that was what the actual report said.
He says, I think it was north, but it was not in any pics, whatever it was or okay, wherever yeah. it was. I'm sorry.
So, because if we're talking actual north, like due north of the bodies, you're not talking about, because the dugout is northwest of the
right.
bodies. So, like, if it actual north of the bodies would be in the woods further north of the bodies. Like, so what are we talking? Is it a pool? Is it a blood spatter? Or did by north mean, like, in general further north, but actually northwest? There's just, and again, it's just like, these are not questions we should have.
I mean, how do you know that you saw something like blood evidence? You know you saw it. You were there. And then I guess after the fact, you just realize, wait, no one photographed that? Like how many people are photographing that someone's like, oh, I thought George got that. Like, that's not, you know what I mean?
It was like, and you're supposed to be setting markers, right? Job. Like you had one job.
Yeah.
Bertozzi's to take those pictures.
It's so strange. I mean, it feels like. Then that's the problem with these cases, is that nobody wants to be a conspiracy theorist. Nobody wants to give fodder to someone on the quote unquote other side to say, okay, listen to yourself. This sounds ridiculous. But when you hear someone say, oh, by the way, there was some blood I didn't photograph, it feels like the next thing you think is, why are you saying that?
Well,
like,
I don't think he said it.
Like, I mean, but.
I don't think he said it quite like that, like Michael just clarified in the chat. So what it is in his report, he describes blood north of the bodies.
Yeah.
But in the crime scene photos, that picture doesn't exist.
Right.
Like he never took a picture of the blood or the, you know, it's splitting hairs, but he didn't say, oh, there was blood and I didn't take a picture of it. We know he didn't take a picture of it because there's no picture.
Right.
But he described that it was there.
Right. But that's also just totally bizarre. I mean, to your point, why would you do that in the moment, like actively already planning on some kind of conspiracy? Like, that doesn't make sense. So then you have to write it off to ineptitude, which is terrifying.
And then at the same time, like you see, oh, there's some blood. I'm going to take time and write down in my report, there's some blood there. And your camera's hanging around your neck and it doesn't occur to you like, oh, better take a picture.
No.
Like it's so bizarre.
No. Lindsay came through with a few more questions. For us today, Lindsay says, not specific to the last episode, but in terms of finding a good case, it seems like you and other podcasts have had success from talking with current or former inmates and Innocence Project organizations. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It is very interesting, the intel from inmates who say, I think, you know, I think this person didn't do this thing. But what do you think about that?
I've had that on a number of occasions. They were just never, I've not had one that like kind of fit the parameters that I would cover on the show. So there's, you know, there have been cases where, you know, it's maybe a sexual assault or a robbery or, you know, so like the sexual assault, as you guys know, I just won't cover those on here because I'm just not re-traumatizing a victim
trying
to figure out if they got the wrong person. I can't do that. Won't do that. And then sometimes, or it's like a robbery where it's like they're innocent. There's not the kind of evidence to work with and the people to interview that we would have to be able to like do anything meaningful with the investigation. Or there are cases where it's like, look, he was there participating in the robbery, but he's not the one that shot him. The other guy shot him. And I approve him that's, you know, that person by all means deserves every bit of defense they can get, but it's just not something that I'm going to take on the podcast. So, but yeah, we're always looking for things like that. The thing with the Innocence Project, we get those all the time. We've done many of them, but it's like, it always worked great with Innocence Project of Texas. We had such a good, and still have such a good working relationship with them. You know, we work very well together where they, you know, they let me go out and do my work. They'll direct me on things they need me to go find for them. And then there's, hey, don't talk about this, but maybe do that. But they're very, very open to, in at least the cases we've worked on and where they were at in litigation wise, to allowing me to like fully continue to do my job and us as an audience to work together to do the job. Most of the time, it's not the case. And when we've got involved with other, you know, it's like, yeah, we want you to do this. And then it's like, but, and for a good reason, their job is to get the client out of prison. Their job isn't to make a podcast. But most of the time when working with attorneys, you run into, okay, I'm like, okay, I think we need to talk to this person. And they're like, that's a great lead. Thank you. Don't tell anybody that and don't go talk to them because we're going to go talk to them, which again is the right thing to do.
Right.
But it's just, it makes it so hard to do, to be able to produce this while doing that. Yeah. So I think the inmate coming in, it's not that I'm not saying I'll never take another case that an Innocence Project or somebody or an attorney brings to me.
Sure.
I'm not going to say that, but I'm really looking for that great case that nobody knows about, where somebody really needs help or they don't have an attorney. And we can really, you know, Jody's case was a great example. We were able to just dig in and go, there was nobody putting the brakes anywhere because no one else was working on the case until it got to the attorney general's office. And then we pass it off to them.
Right, right. Just very quickly, too, I see Michael says, by the way, regarding this case, by the way, the Tempo was a two-door with a baby seat in the back on the driver's side.
Right, which pretty much says there could only have been one other person in the car. But I also, if I remember correctly, I think I read somewhere that we don't have a picture of this, but I feel like I read somewhere where I think the passenger side, that the seat was pushed forward like they do when you like to get out of a back seat of a car, which would indicate there was a third person in the back seat. But with the baby seat, I mean, I guess you could fit two people back there, but it's not a big car and the baby seat's taking up half the back seat.
I mean, yeah, speaking as someone who has been wedged into the middle between a baby seat and another person, it's possible. Depending on, yeah, people's sizes and stuff. Lindsay also says a quick Google search shows that there could be some AI tools that could read lips for the video, such as Google's DeepMind and Oxford's LipNet. And I will just give my own personal opinion and say there is a certain irony to the fact that AI cannot get lip flaps right on the generating side.
Right. Yeah.
That's the only thing that makes me nervous is that whenever I see AI, I'm like, that mouth does not work at all. Like the physics of forming words with your tongue and teeth, AI has a really hard time with. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on the flip side of that. Can AI effectively read lips?
I've never tried it, but I wouldn't with this one anyway, because I've had many people reach out, listeners who are either trained to read lips or, you know, are friends with people that are very fluent in reading lips that have all looked at it. And they've all pretty much said the same thing. He's not saying anything. Like what they can all tell you
right.
is that what he's saying is not lining up with the transcript, because some of them are just read lips, but several of them were people who are deaf and can't hear it and only read lips. So they were comparing the transcript to what he was saying. And the consensus is 100% across the board. The way he's moving, it looks like he's not really talking. He's not saying anything. Like there's nothing. Like if I was standing there talking to him, I would have no idea what he's saying.
Right.
But what I can tell you is he's not saying what's on the transcript.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that makes sense in the sense that if the takeaway is, for whatever reason, the video happens afterwards and it is to bolster the viability of that audio tape. Think about what you see on TikTok and Instagram and stuff now, especially when like kids are quote unquote lip syncing, but they need to move quickly. They don't really know the lyrics to the song,
yeah.
but they're just communicating the idea that they're lip syncing and they're just moving their mouths. They're not, every once in a while, maybe you click on a lyric that you know
yeah.
and you'll see, and it changes, right? You see it lock in, and our brains, because we're little animals who are taking in information and processing it and trying to make sense of it, that we feel the uncanny valley of someone not quite saying the words that they're supposedly saying when the lip flaps match. That's lip flaps is a term that we use in voiceover all the time, just in case everyone's wondering. That's an official term. But And then when they fall back out, or someone from a different culture who maybe doesn't speak the same language, but they're lip syncing to a song in this other language, you know, you can just feel the difference between having that understanding of exactly what you're saying and mimicking it perfectly and just kind of doing it for performative sake, which is, again, totally fine. But to me, that tracks. It tracks that you would be like, the important thing is that it's my voice. I said it. And now we just need to kind of move my mouth so yeah. it is clear that, like, I know what this is happening and I'm the one that said the words, but that it's not needed, that maybe I don't need to articulate it that clearly, or otherwise we would have found a way for me to read it or whatever.
Yeah. It would have been a lot better if he just took a video of him holding the affidavit saying, I'm Gerald Matthews and I did do this.
That's a really, really simple way of getting potentially the exact same information that they were hoping to get across with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
True.
If we only had a time
machine.
Which
is why it's so baffling.
It's like, yeah.
It's so baffling.
We wouldn't be having these weird conversations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And then finally from Lindsay, I keep coming back to the fact that only a small portion of the recorded audio is different from the notarized text. I'm wondering how this fits into your current theory of the video, which we basically covered. Anything you want to add based on
It makes me more confused in the fact that, well, I guess it doesn't really, if I really think about it, because the idea was that I think that the affidavit was written first. And then the recording was made. The way it sounds to me, just inflections and stuff in his voice, when he adds that little bit in the middle, it seems like, you know, the way I took that is though he was reading it, and then he got that part and he was like, oh yeah, there's this other thing I need to add in there. and he added it in. So I think that I was going to say it really confused the issue, but it doesn't, because the video really doesn't. If the video, what's happening in the video is what I think is happening in the video, then it really doesn't play into it, because that already happened. There's already the difference between the audio and the written transcript. The video of him just sitting there, just moving his lips around, doesn't change anything with that at all.
Right. And I just want to quickly scroll back, because Michael mentioned one more thing about the tempo. Michael, are you allowed to talk about this stuff? I feel like we're getting some really juicy information in here that we didn't know. But he says, also, nothing in the reports but the tempo ignition switch was broken.
Yeah.
So do with that information what you will.
Yeah. And it looks like, and it didn't Tasha tell us that they had to start it with a screwdriver or something? That's why the club was in there?
You know what? I think that that's right.
Yeah.
Well, I thought the club was in there because he didn't want her to be able to take the car out whenever she wanted. I thought that was the joke that Tasha made.
Yeah. Well,
that was also true.
Yeah. But I think that it was the reason there was a concern about her taking it whenever she wanted is because you didn't need a key for it.
Oh, maybe that's right.
Because
I just tromped down.
She definitely
down
told
on
me that. I don't know if it was on the air or off the air, but
she probably did. I so clearly remembered like chuckling about the idea of the club. Yeah. And why it was there.
And that's interesting. So like what was never collected is a club or a screwdriver or anything that we know that would be used to start the car.
The club thing is also, I mean, if it was there.
Right.
And it was used. That's maddening. Maddening. And then finally, we have this post. There was a really long, very interesting and thorough post that Juan posted on the Truth and Justice official fans Facebook page. And we're not going to read the whole thing verbatim. We're just going to kind of sum it up a little bit. But I'd love to just kind of go over this as sort of maybe our last thing, our last official thing. So Juan's post lay out a lot of evidence, developed a theory. He points out that in Chris Bynum's first statement, Chris claims he does not know Terrell, then later says they worked together at Job Corp in Chicago and Gary, and that the shift happens right after the detective corrects Bynum when he slips and says the name Chris. Juan questions whether detectives steered that story to cover that slip and then connect Bynum to Chicago. Does that track for you?
Yeah.
Let's just take that by itself. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think that the detective steered the whole thing. So
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Chris slip to me read to me as though he was like kind of reading off of notes. And that's why he said Chris and not me, because he was reading off of notes. The detective changing it to he knew Terrell from working in Job Corps together. I don't know. I don't know that what the utility really is there. I guess I can see some of it. I think it was just a shit show, really, personally. Like it was a completely made up nonsense story. And when you have a made up nonsense story, you end up with all kinds of details and plot holes that don't line up.
So at the end of the day, just to refresh us, do you feel like he didn't know Terrell and that all of that was just kind of like, well, we're gonna have to connect you to this, so we need you to say this?
I don't have enough information to know.
Yeah.
You know, I have him saying he doesn't and then him saying he did.
Right.
And I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it now. I don't know what he's ever said about it post then. So, yeah, I don't have enough information to even make an educated guess.
Understood. Okay. Juan also notes that Rob G. Carr worked for a carpet cleaning company tied to an address in Indianapolis. And Juan points out that's the same city where the Gerald Matthews confession tapes originated. And in fact, even one name that Juan found that was linked to Rob seemed similar to the woman who had been listed on that return address. But Juan was like, I think it was Michelle Williams, which that's such a common name. Probably
yeah,
even
so
Juan
it was actually,
like, I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to pause here with this for just a minute. So it was Melissa Williams.
I'm sorry.
I think Juan had wrote Michelle in his post. But yeah, the return address was Melissa Williams. And Juan, if this was you, this is the best way I know how to get this out for everybody. I think it was Juan. I was telling Janet in the pre-show, somebody had sent me an email who either must work with an attorney, have resources, or be some kind of investigator, that they had done some searching into all of this. Is why I think it was actually, I think it very likely was Juan who sent me this email. But somehow I could not find that email anymore. But in the email, they had asked if the return address started with a certain number, ended with a number, because they're trying to fact check themselves. So this is what I'll give you, if it was you, Juan, or whoever it was, or anybody else that's checking this. So the return address on the envelope, it was addressed to Melissa Williams. It was a four-digit address. It started with 6 and ended in 7. And I think that was the question. If I remember correctly, the email I got was, did it end in 5? It didn't. It was started with 6, ended in 7. And I'll give you the street. It was Croquet Place. So the return address was 6 blank blank 7 Croquet Place. I just don't want to give the exact address because I don't want somebody bothering. This person has nothing to do with any of this.
Right.
Which you shouldn't do anyway, by the way, ever. But yeah, so I just want that information out there for who, if it was Juan or whoever that is chasing down all these different connections. That was it. It was 6 blank blank 7 Croquet Place in Indianapolis.
Okay. Any thoughts on the idea that Rob Carr maybe having some sort of connection to the origin, the address that was listed on the return for those tapes? You feel like there could be something there?
If it matches up, that would be significant.
Right.
But I don't know what Juan has found, the exact address Juan has found. That's why I wanted to put that out there. So they can either, Juan can either email me, or I don't care if we have to, probably better to email me directly or private message me about it. So we're not putting all this information out all over the place. But I would say this, if that address is, hey, that address is somebody who Rob Carr worked for or worked with or has a direct connection to Rob Carr all the way down in Indianapolis, and Gerald Matthews used that, or whoever sent us Gerald Matthews' confession, which was supposedly Roger Shannon, if Roger Shannon happened to use that exact same address for, well, now there's a full real connection with the confession that definitely needs to be looked into closer. So yeah. I'm really curious where this shakes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, next, Juan highlights that the callback number Liz received matched closely with the number for the Sporting Life liquor store, and Juan suggests that someone may have used a nearby payphone and that the liquor store could have been a base of activity. So this is, he lists the phone number. It's got the same first 3 digits and then different last 4 digits. They're not, like, it's not like they're 1 digit off from each other.
I think they're the same numbers. They're just arranged differently.
Maybe. I don't remember looking at the number that way. I just remember looking at it and saying, okay, well, it's not like it's like 3456 and then the next is 3457. But
it's interesting. It may be something, but also I think that we got to be pretty clear. Okay. I see what he's saying. I was like, we pretty much know. I mean, she told her she was going to the Sporting Life liquor store. So we assume the text came from there. But I think what he's saying is the phone number is the one that they said, the callback number that they said matched Chris Bynum's number was real close, which, again, there's so many rabbit holes to go down here, because that's the page you didn't sign. That's the page that was not typed up. There's no question. There's only an answer, no question. There's all that other stuff in there. So again, I mean, it's very possible, but there's also a lot of ambiguity there and a lot of leaps we have, which to be clear, the way Juan didn't put all this is, hey, this is a bombshell. Juan just said that this is something interesting to think about. And I agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and that sort of leads into his theory, the theory being that there could have been a payphone right next to or right outside of the liquor store, and the person in question could have placed a call from that phone and then had a conversation like, how did you get this number? Or, yes, I am carrying. Mm-hmm. If you want to meet me at this place, we can discuss that. So Juan posits a possibility being that Liz and Sheila went to Gerald looking for drugs, and that this recap is so simple that I probably should look up the actual post, because I'm looking at it now. I'm like, oh, this is skipping a bunch of stuff in between.
Well, I think she said that Liz would have like called AMP and said he was looking.
And said, where could I get something?
And AMP would direct him to Gerald's pager.
Yeah.
Pages Gerald. And then I think the rest of the theory pretty much tracks with what he had said.
That then Gerald and Shaky followed them to AMP's house from the liquor store. I think part of the reason of that, the idea was like, who's dropping my name? This,
right.
I don't know this woman. Mm-hmm. How did she get my name that I would have drugs to sell, and that they would all go, that they all end up going to AMP's house, and that perhaps the argument that we are told occurred at the house could have been a confrontation wherein, you know, Gerald and perhaps Shaky confront Amp and say, you know, why are you giving out my number to people you don't know? That there's that somehow that could help explain the idea of like Liz better not come back here. And then the parties in question that do leave the house go to the ball field, and that Gerald is the one who attacks Liz. If she, for example, refuses some sort of sexual provocation, that Gerald shot both women. Shaky could have cleaned up and fled. Gerald picked him up and the pair tried to repair things by bringing drugs to Amp's. And then they return with Rob G and kill everyone inside to eliminate witnesses before leaving with Rob to destroy evidence.
Yeah, essentially it's said, you know, they, which I think there's parts of this that are we can be reasonably suspect that it's a really good theory of what happened, which is I think I'm comfortable saying that Liz texts somebody and was going to the liquor store to meet them to do drugs. As Michael just said in the chat, in that part of Indiana, at least it's like liquor store parking lots are a very common place for drugs deals to go down. Mm-hmm. I think so they went and met whoever it was there, whether it was Gerald or whether it was Rob G or some person we don't even know, Joe Tidwell, whoever, that then they went from there. The timing, I think, works that they went from there to Amp's house. And Juan's theory that was, you know, maybe some confrontation about, you know, hey, why did you give my name? But I don't know. I don't know that world. Like, is the drug dealer happy for the business, or they're like, hey,
right?
Why,
that was my thought too. I was not, yeah. Just not sure.
But for whatever reason, they go there, and then there's some sort of argument there, and then a group of them leave. Liz, Sheila, and whoever else leave and go to the ball field, and then those murders happen. And then they return back. And I think in Juan's theory where he laid it all out was that they go back to the house to go, you know, smoke, do drugs with them, is just kind of like chill things out. Like, hey, you know, we're all good. And then whatever happened in there, you know, during that, let them know, no, they're not good. Maybe there's some truth in what Gerald's confession says, right? That the women in the house were saying, no, we're not, you know, we're going to call the police or we're going to tell whatever. And they're like, well, we're just going to wipe out everybody then. They killed everybody and left. So I think it's some version of that story. I think that the moving parts definitely work, right? So the call for Michelle's, go to liquor store, get drugs from the drugs, from the liquor store. They go to Amp's. We know there was a visit to Amp's. There was a conversation there. Seems like if we believe Willie that Liz was part of that, then there's a trip to the ball field. We know that timing works. Murders happen there, back to the house. And I think, and I'm comfortable saying that whatever happened with everything else, that scene at the house, the murder scene at the house, was absolutely to kill the witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Which you've said from the beginning.
Yeah. So yeah. Whether that's Gerald or Rob G, I don't know. I am very curious if that connection with that address does connect back to Rob G in some way. So I'll be looking forward to hearing from Juan or whoever that was doing that. Again, my apologies for losing that email. So, and we'll see if there's a connection there. It's just so hard for me. We have so many names and people thrown around. The only one that's consistently thrown through it is always Shaky. Rob G comes through with all of the, you know, it's like I said at the beginning, you know, Gerald Matthews throws a kink into this whole thing. So, you know, we're going to keep just, so as we move on and start covering other things and having other people on the show as we're moving forward, just know that like all this stuff is still being worked on. I'm still working on all of this stuff. And there are some listeners that are working with me and helping do stuff. So like there are all these things that are happening behind the scenes. We're just not talking about them. And if we have something that we find that's significant, well, first to get shared with the lawyers, and then at some point it'll get shared with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last thing I'll say, and I know you said you may have something you wanted to mention towards the end of our conversation, but you know, I think always nice to touch in with this. These are all human beings. We do not know. This is speculation. We are attempting to get justice for the victims and justice for Chris Bynum. But the last thing we want to do is be careless and exchange one black gentleman for another, because that is what it feels that the police did. So all of these people are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. We're just trying to figure out the truth.
Yeah. And that segues us into Sunday's episode. Like I said, I was already planning on covering what your rights are with interactions with police and what your custodial situation is and what your rights are in those different situations. And then I was actually thinking about addressing it today, but I don't want to address it with the chat or with Janet, because it's going to be, it's probably going to be a bit of an uncomfortable conversation. But somebody made a post asking a question on the follow-up, or excuse me, on our Facebook page that suggested when I cover that information, that given some recent events, I talk about how that would play into with other agencies. I'm sure you guys can figure out where I'm kind of going with that. And that's just going to be an uncomfortable conversation, but it is something that I've been kind of really wrestling with for the last couple of days, if I even want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But I am going to, because I think it's necessary and important to talk about. And when I say that, I'm talking about the laws, our rights in interactions like that. So we'll be talking about some of that. Probably going to make some people mad. I'm hoping not to. I'm going to do my best not to. But I feel strongly enough about it that as far as everyone's safety, that I think that the conversation needs to happen. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that in Sunday's episode too. So just be ready for that. Just be ready for that. We'll see how it goes. And I'm going to do it without a script. So we'll see how that goes too, because I just need to be able to just talk. So we'll be talking about all that on Sunday. Thank you guys for being here tonight, and thanks for listening, tuning in every week. And we can't wait to talk to you guys about all of that next Monday when we record next week's follow-up. Forgot how to end an episode. Bye, guys.
Thanks, everybody. And bye, guys, on behalf of Zach.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. Co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.